In Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,375 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 38,660 civilians have been reportedly killed by military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Oregon is now only one of seven states with no interest cap on payday loans. But legislatures this week are expected to pass a new state law limiting interest to 36% a year and enacting other consumer protections for borrowers of payday loans. The special session set to begin Thursday was called by Governor Ted Kieslowski to funnel more state aid to struggling school districts and to plug a $136 million budget hole in Oregon's health and human services programs. In Oregon, the payday loan industry has grown quickly in a few years. Consumer advocates say a new state law is needed to protect people from lenders who at times charge more than 500% interest. The last time the legislature met, in the regular 2005 session, a bill to limit interest rates on payday loans was approved by Democrat-controlled Senate, but died in the Republican-controlled House. That measure was shelved by a House committee chairman who was angry about insinuations by campaign finance watchdog group that House Speaker Karen Minnis and other GOP lawmakers had been bought off with campaign contributors from the payday loan industry. The payday loan dispute has become an issue in Minnis' re-election campaign, with her Democratic challenger for the seat, Rob Brading, championing payday reform in the House Speaker's East Multnomah County District. For KBOO News, I'm Sheila Whiteside reporting.
The Willamette River is the third most endangered river in the country because of a continued industrial pollution, according to a prominent conservation group. American Rivers named the Pajaro River in California, the Upper Yellowstone River in Montana, and Oregon's Willamette River as the most endangered rivers in America in its annual report. The report claims Oregon laws that allow the dumping of toxic chemicals by industry are the main source of pollution. The Willamette River runs through areas occupied by 70% of Oregon's population, including major cities of Eugene, Salem, and Portland. The Willamette then spills into the Columbia at the confluence just north of downtown Portland. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality says it is seeking funding to better identify sources of toxic releases to the water.
Even though most racially and ethnically diverse groups are more educated and arrest-free than in 1990, progress in this small but growing part of Oregon's population has slowed or reversed since 2000 for eighth-grade reading, prenatal care, poverty, arrests, and home ownership. According to a report issued today called Oregon Benchmarks, a report on the progress of Oregon's racially and ethnically diverse populations. The report compares benchmark trends on education, health and safety, and financial status for Oregon's racial and ethnic populations. For instance, the state's largest and fastest growing diverse population, Hispanics, fared worse than non-Hispanics in all of the Oregon benchmarks examined. Hispanics were in poverty at a greater rate in 2004 than in 2000. Hispanics and American Indians, in particular, have lower high school and college completion rates and are in poverty at a higher rate in Oregon than their counterparts nationwide. Oregon's racially and ethnically diverse populations grew from 7% in 1990 to 13% in 2004. Hispanics made up most of Oregon's diverse populations that year, having grown to 10% of the population, up from 4% in 1990. Despite its increasing diversity, Oregon is significantly less diverse than the U.S.
A new report says the Portland area needs to start reducing demand for oil soon, or the regional economy will suffer. The report is by Metro, the regional government for the three counties that make up Portland and its suburbs. Metro Councilor Rex Burkholder says the oil supply has to be taken into account for all of the council's policy-making decisions in the future. Burkholder says he's not trying to be an alarmist, but he says it's time to raise awareness about the expected worldwide oil shortage so the city can make an effort to head off serious problems. The Metro report and the Portland City Council effort to establish an oil supply task force are part of a larger effort nationally by other major cities, including Denver, Oakland, and others.
A tiny chemical reactor that converts vegetable oil directly into biodiesel could help farmers turn some of their crops into homegrown fuel to operate agriculture equipment instead of relying on costly imported oil. The device, about the size of a credit card, pumps vegetable oil and alcohol, through tiny parallel channels, each smaller than a human hair, to convert the oil into biodiesel almost instantly. By comparison, it takes more than a day to produce biodiesel with current technology. Conventional production involves dissolving a catalyst, such as sodium hydroxide in alcohol, then stirring it into vegetable oil in large vats for about 2 hours. The mixture then has to sit for 12 to 24 hours while a slow chemical reaction forms biodiesel along with glycerin, a byproduct. Biodiesel production on the farm also could reduce distribution costs by eliminating the need for tanker truck fuel delivery, part of the growing effort to meet fuel demand locally instead of relying on distant refineries and tanker transport.
Corporations in Oregon may have to disclose how much they actually pay in taxes. That's if a leading advocacy group gets its way. KBOO's Doug Guidi reports.
Oregon State Initiative 102 is a proposal that will not be popular for the many corporations that find Oregon attractive due to its current lax laws and how much they pay in corporate taxes. This initiative would change how little many of these corporations pay in taxes. Under the Corporate Accountability Reporting proposal, corporations would be paying a larger but more fair percentage of the state. That's according to a report released by well-known grassroots advocacy group, Oregon Center for Public Policy. It's investigated why these corporations are paying so little when Oregon continues to struggle to operate and support state services. Chuck Chutkoff is from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. He believes it's time for the state to reform its corporate tax laws.
I think the petitions and get the ballot signatures in so that Oregonians can vote on it, and that will help really go a long way toward changing the climate for changes in the corporate tax code. When it exposes which companies that are profitable and large are not paying their fair share in taxes, I think the legislature and voters will next move will be to reform the corporate income tax.
One disturbing factor out of the report is a finding that shows 2 out of 3 corporations doing business in Oregon only pay $10 annually in corporate income taxes. Oregon is the only state with the corporate kicker. The kicker gives personal income tax and corporate tax payments when economic projections for the 2-year budget cycle exceed by at least 2%. Many, like the OCPP, feel the money should be set aside in a rainy day fund. The Initiative Petition 102, the Corporate Accountability Reporting Act, covers only large corporations, not small businesses. Small businesses, corporations with fewer than 250 employees and less than $10 million in sales in a year, and corporations where employee owners are performing personal services, would be exempt. Groups such as the Oregon Center of Public Policy expect a good fight from corporate interests when they push harder for the proposed reform of Oregon Initiative 102. Chuck Chutkoff.
Some organized labor groups are going to be supporting it, and we haven't seen yet whether or not business community is going to fight it, how hard they're going to fight it. So that's all sort of conjecture at this moment. I don't think they've set up a pack yet to fight it. But sometimes with initiatives, it's not the dollar amount that's spent, it's the quality. It's the issue sometimes survives tilted dollar figures.
The Oregon Center of Public Policy also feels the public acknowledgement is also good for business overall in Oregon. It claims it will show that corporations selling to Oregonians and operating in Oregon can make a profit. Oregon bases corporate taxes on those profits, not revenues. Also, the OCPP feels the information that's made public will help Oregonians decide which businesses are better for the overall business climate. The bottom line is Oregonians will know who is paying their fair share of corporate taxes and who isn't. I'm Doug Guidi, KBOO News.
Rural school districts in Oregon have the widest funding gap in the nation, and students in rural districts that receive the most tax money outperform those in rural districts that receive less. This is reported in a new national study. The Rural School and Community Trust compared financial resources, poverty, and community education levels of 132 small and rural districts with student performance on state reading and math tests. Researcher Jerry Johnson, an Ohio University education professor, said money had the highest correlation of 4 factors that showed an influence on student achievement. The second most important influence on achievement, Johnson said, was teacher quality, as measured by whether the teachers had emergency or provisional teaching credentials. The other factors with influence were poverty, as measured by the percentage of students qualified for free or reduced lunch, and educational level in the community, as measured by the percent of adults in the community with a college degree. Johnson's study showed an average difference of $1,625 per student between high-achieving and low-achieving rural districts. The study included school districts in cities of 2,500 residents or less. It included several districts on the fringe of the Portland metropolitan area, including Corbett and Banks.
A priceless collection of documents, long considered lost, have been returned to local mountaineers, the Mazamas. Missing since the 1970s, this trove includes the Mount Hood Summit Register for the years 1891 to 1895, the Mount St. Helens Summit Register from 1898 through 1908, and a volume of Mazamas Council Minutes covering meetings from March 1894 through December 1898. Forgotten for decades in the laundry room of a Portland residence, the documents are back in the Mazama archives in remarkably good condition. The volume of minutes includes a record of the 4 months of discussions that led up to that founding climb, as well as notes of the earliest meetings of the new organization. These leather-bound tomes are the only existing records of the events they chronicle and will be an invaluable resource for future historians. The Mazamas, founded in 1894 on the summit of Mount Hood, is a nonprofit mountaineering organization located in Portland, Oregon, offering over 500 hikes and 250 climbs annually. Activities offered for every skill and fitness level are open to both members and non-members. To become a Mazama, you must climb to the summit of a glaciated mountain peak. Over 3,000 are currently members.
The first of three California condor chicks due this spring at the Oregon Zoo has hatched. Zookeepers say the condor chick arrived over the weekend. Both its mother and father are taking good care of it. If the chick survives, it will be the fifth from Oregon since 2003, when the zoo joined a multi-million dollar attempt to restore the endangered species. Two more condor chicks are expected in the Oregon Zoo breeding program this year.
Interesting things have been washing up on Oregon beaches lately. A species of shark that rarely washes up on shore was found, and a creature known as a purple sail is starting to make its annual appearance on the Oregon coast. Seaside Aquarium's Tiffany Booth said a seven-gill shark wound up on Sunset Beach last Thursday. While the species is not rare, it's rarely seen on Oregon's coast. In the realm of beach wonders, Velella Vella are starting to show up on the beach. The small, purplish, slimy things wash up in great numbers in spring or early summer. Nicknamed purple sails, this form of jellyfish brings out flocks of seagulls to feed on them when they wash up, and they start to smell rather pungently after a while. Once they dry, they lose their purple color and become translucent. Also, a recent spate of ocean burps on the north coast yielded some unusual finds for the Seaside Aquarium. Found among these upwellings of objects churned up during stormy periods was a clutch of squid eggs. The eggs, which were taken to the aquarium, are starting to form, and it looks like they may have a small group of infant squid on their hands soon.
In the old days, most folks grew mostly three types of potatoes in their home gardens, bakers, boilers, and reds, but many more new and heirloom varieties are now available through catalogs and specialty producers than ever before. Yellow flesh potatoes not only have a rich buttery color, they are flavorful, creamy, and moist in texture without having to add butter or sauces. Based on variety trials at the Oregon State University Vegetable Research Farm, they recommend the following yellow fleshed varieties: Yellowfin, Yukon Gold, and Desiree. Fingerling potatoes, small in size but big in flavor, are popular in other countries and gaining favor here with gourmet cooks. Most are smooth textures, moist, and great flavored. Fingerling varieties include giant peanut fingerlings, German yellow, and Ozette. Spuds with purple flesh are also appearing in garden catalogs, garden stores, and restaurant plates. OSU recommends all blue as performing well in Oregon. Finally, OSU recommended red potatoes, including red Pontiac, Norland, and red La Soda, cranberry red, and red gold. Recommended white potatoes are russet Burbank, Superior, Gold, Rush, and Kennebec.
And now, another edition of KBOO's homegrown environmental series, Our Backyard, produced by Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, the economic value of ecological service provided by bugs and a campaign to protect natural areas and clean water.
A new study in the April issue of the journal Bioscience shows that insects provide services worth more than $57 billion annually to Americans. Insects are food for wildlife that supports a $50 billion recreation industry. Native insects provide more than $4.5 billion in pest control and pollinate $3 billion in crops and clean up grazing lands with a subsequent savings to ranchers of more than $380 million. According to John Losey, associate professor of entomology at Cornell University, these are very conservative estimates that probably represent only a fraction of the true value. Native insects and their interactions form the biological foundation of all ecosystems. Invertebrates cycle nutrients, pollinate crops and other plants, disperse seeds, maintain soil structure and fertility, exert control over population of other organisms, and provide a major food source. In short, they supply absolutely vital ecological services to the entire human population. To estimate the value that insects provide for each of these services, the authors of the study looked at current spending in the U.S. economy that relies on a service provided by a native insect. When considering the allocation of conservation resources or the management of natural habitat, the researchers pointed out that we must make certain that insects can continue to do their beneficial work by protecting the environment. These ecologically valued bugs are also directly connected to a unanimously approved resolution by the Metro Council that refers to voters a $227 million bond measure to purchase natural areas, preserve fish and wildlife habitat, and protect water quality. Metro is the directly elected regional government for more than 1.3 million residents in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, and the 25 cities in the Portland, Oregon metropolitan area. Last week, the Oregonian reported that while no former opposition has emerged for the bond measure, the open spaces proposal isn't a sure thing. The article quoted Eric Squires, a trade show consultant and the new leader of a citizen involvement group in the Aloha area. He predicts the measure will likely be rejected in the competition for taxpayer dollars on this November's ballot that already includes renewals of a Portland levy for children's services and a Multnomah County library levy, a new Lake Oswego Community Center, and school spending requests in Portland, Beaverton, and North Clackamas County. Squires believes Metro should tax the construction industry instead of proposing a bond, tying spending to newcomers who create the need for more recreational areas. No matter how much people enjoy open spaces, they might prioritize basic services in November, Squires said. But local supporters, which include the Audubon Society of Portland, the Coalition for a Livable Future, cyclist organizations, urban fauna, and others, including city governments, all agree this is the region's best chance to protect vulnerable land before development gets planned or prices spike. The bond measure would cost 19 cents for every $1,000 of assessed value, or $47.50 a year for a $250,000 home. That rate will decrease over the course of the 20-year bond as more homes and businesses locate in Metro's territory in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. And with another million residents expected in the region by 2030, environmentalists say acquiring new land is one effective way to prevent habitat loss. And last year, a study co-sponsored by the National Wildlife Federation predicted development would pave 11% of the Portland area's remaining open space within two decades unless steps to protect what remains are taken. Metro is charged with being responsible to the citizens of the region and working cooperatively with local governments and undertaking as its most important service planning and policymaking to preserve and enhance the quality of life and the environment for today and future generations. This measure measures up to that responsibility. It's worth supporting. Oh, and the bugs will appreciate it too. Keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
The current time is 5:23. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, the White House is making several surprising changes in their staff, including a change in advisor Karl Rove's positioning. Women's rights appear to be waning in Iraq under Prime Minister al-Jafari's leadership. And hear how the worst driver in Scotland has been banned from driving for a total of 9 lifetimes. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Halliburton has been awarded a contract worth almost half a billion dollars to construct immigrant detention centers around the country. Progressive Magazine Washington editor Ruth Conniff has researched the issue and spoke earlier today with KABU reporter Lisa Loving.
They have a new contract, and on their website, the Halliburton website, I got a copy of a press release from dated January 24th talking about this $385 million contract to build emergency detention centers in case there was a large influx of illegal immigrants into our country, an emergency that really probably most of your listeners haven't given a lot of thought to because it doesn't really seem like it's on the radar screen. But nonetheless, Homeland Security is preparing for such an event, and it raises a lot of questions about, you know, what are these detention centers, what would their use be, and, you know, what exactly are they envisioning? I was sort of given a heads up on this from somebody who's done some work for Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin, the Democrat who's currently sponsoring a very controversial resolution to censure the president. And I think that Feingold is looking into, you know, the specific process by which Halliburton was awarded this contract. And I think there are a couple of different issues that are of concern. One is, you know, obviously, any time Halliburton gets any sort of a contract, you know, one wonders about corruption and the overcharges that they're famous for and just the inside track that Halliburton seems to have on these massive government contracts, given that Dick Cheney is the former CEO of the company. There doesn't seem to be any accountability. They've gotten many no-bid contracts in Iraq and done the work for far more than other contractors, local contractors. So that's, you know, that's one issue. One issue is just wasting taxpayer money. Another issue is the constitutional issues that are raised in an era when we are seeing, you know, an administration that's willing to classify American citizens as enemies of that. That is a real concern. What kind of future is it where we have massive detention centers where we're holding people for long periods of time? And it's reminiscent of some ugly periods in our nation's history. Certainly, you know, the Japanese internment camps during World War II, where people were rounded up because of an ethnic origin that, you know, was that they shared with someone, you know, with a group of people that were enemies of the United States, U.S. citizens who were, you know, regular, hardworking folks who had no connection whatsoever to the Japanese war effort were put in these, you know, lost everything, were put in these camps. So, you know, one shudders to think about those kinds of possibilities. I mean, another point that's been raised about it, that Pacific News Service raised about it, was that this president was urged by some people in his administration to declare martial law after Hurricane Katrina, and martial law seems like a very short step from where we are currently with the doctrine of the war on terror. It's an ill-defined and potentially infinite war, and, you know, it can be used as a justification for all kinds of attacks on people's constitutional rights and liberties. And, you know, that these detention centers raise the specter of, you know, these emergency conditions being declared and people being detained without any kind of regular due process.
One of the things that strikes me about it as well is that it seems to represent a significant escalation of the prison industrial complex. Just building a facility or even a system of facilities like that would only be the beginning, because then, of course, you have to maintain them. And we've seen in our state of Oregon where a women's prison was built some few years ago to house a couple thousand women, where previously there were only something like 250 incarcerated women in the state of Oregon. Now there's a couple thousand. I guess what I'm asking is, do you have a sense that this is the beginning of a whole new system which will have to be supported economically by our government? Do you have a sense about that?
Well, I think it's speculation at this point, but it does raise a third issue besides the waste of taxpayer money through this particular defense contractor and the civil liberties concern, and that is defense contractors getting into the domestic prison business. And the use of defense contractors, certainly in New Orleans, there were a number of them who were doing work for the government directly related to disaster relief, beginning to use defense contractors in and the military domestically in emergencies is certainly, you know, a precedent that should raise a lot of civilian concern. And again, it goes to this idea of martial law and just mixing up the difference between, you know, issues of immigration control, domestic, you know, law enforcement and politics, and a state of war, which, you know, the war on terror is, it's called a state of war, but it's not like any other state of war we've ever been in. So it you know, provides an opportunity to blur these lines.
The United Nations Committee Against Torture has demanded that the United States provide more information about its treatment of prisoners at home and of foreign terrorism suspects held in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. In questions submitted to Washington, the panel also sought information about secret detention facilities and specifically whether the United States assumed responsibility for alleged acts of torture in them, UN officials said this yesterday. Washington is expected to send a delegation of 30 officials to defend its record next month in Geneva at a meeting of the committee, composed of 10 independent human rights experts. The debate, set up for May 5th and May 8th, we'll focus on a report filed a year ago by the United States on its compliance with the Convention Against Torture, which bans all forms of torture. It also challenged some practices in U.S. domestic jails, such as imprisoning juveniles with adults, which is banned under U.S. law. It cited a report that, quote, detained women are kept shackled during childbirth, while other detainees are chained in gangs. The U.N. panel, which meets twice a year, will also examine the records of Georgia, Guatemala, Peru, Qatar, South Korea, and Togo at its May 1st to 19th session.
30 students began a sit-in at Florida Governor Jeb Bush's office this morning. From WMNF in Tampa, Andrew Stelzer reports.
The students occupying the governor's office are upset that no one has been held responsible for the death of a 14-year-old African-American who was beaten by guards at a juvenile boot camp in the Florida Panhandle.
Here we have a videotape clearly showing the guard beating this young boy to death, and nothing has been done. You know, over 100 days already, and the time for diplomacy has run out.
Gabriel Appendis, president of the Student Senate at Florida State University, was one of millions of outraged Floridians when the initial autopsy found that Martin Lee Anderson had died from sickle cell trait and not from the beating by seven guards. This despite the fact that ammonia tablets were stuffed up his nose during the beating. The students are calling for the release of a second autopsy, a civil suit against the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the Bay County Sheriff's Office, the arrest of the seven guards who beat Anderson and the nurse who watched the beating and didn't intervene, the revocation of the medical license of the initial medical examiner, and an apology by Governor Jeb Bush, the state attorney general, and head of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Bush has said he will meet with the students in private, but Pendis said the meeting must be open to the press and they're prepared to stay until their demands are met.
This is a public issue that has been covered up already by members of our government and needs to be brought to light. And anything that he can say to us, he can say to the people of our state who are requesting that justice be served today.
For FSRN, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
About 50 homeless people and their supporters recently gathered outside City Hall in St. Petersburg, Florida. They protested an ordinance allowing law enforcement to arrest or cite those sleeping or sitting on the grassy areas of city parks after the closing time of each park. 30 of those protesters slept the night on the sidewalk in front of the building as a sign of solidarity with the nearly 5,000 homeless in Pinellas County. Opponents of the ordinance say that it criminalizes homelessness and does nothing to reduce the problem. FSRN's Emily Reddy has more from St. Petersburg.
Under the newly revived ordinance, they're still allowed to sleep on sidewalks. So the people in sleeping bags spread across the concrete outside City Hall weren't actually breaking the law. Reverend Bruce Wright, director of Refuge Ministries and organizer of this event, says that the homeless are being kicked off the streets without being given anywhere else to stay. The city has told him that 25 new shelter beds have been added, but he says that's not enough.
It's a drop in the bucket. It's disingenuous. They got to involve the people that are affected by it, you know, and they're not.
Matt Flagey, a member of Eckerd College Homeless Outreach, says that Pinellas County isn't actually working on the problem of homelessness.
The city, unfortunately, rather than providing adequate services or addressing homelessness at its root cause, has tried instead to just push the problem out of the downtown area.
There ain't nobody reached out to me in this damn town. I got hit on the city streets, hit and run, right down here.
Peg DeHue lives on the streets in a wheelchair. She was seriously injured in a hit-and-run auto accident 14 months ago. She says that the police harass her, and she's afraid of what they might do to her now that this ordinance is in place. DeHue chose not to spend the night in front of City Hall.
I know I was real angry, and I sounded real angry. I'm not angry at the people here. I think people are really trying to do something, and this shows me that they are. The thing that's very frightening for me is that the homeless people are afraid to be here because there's a carload of cops right there, and everybody's afraid they're going to go to jail.
Reverend Wright says that this ordinance is a part of the county's 10-year plan to end homelessness, adopted in response to a call for action to counties around the United States by President Bush.
You know why there's a 10-year plan? Let's get real honest. The federal government said, if the county doesn't have a 10-year plan, it's telling counties all over America, if you don't have a 10-year plan, your funding's going to be cut.
Activists are considering lawsuits should the ordinance be enforced. Reverend Wright says that there will be future protests, and he also plans to continue to sleep on the streets with the homeless periodically to make sure that they are not being harassed. With FSRN, this is Emily Reddy.
An appeals court today upheld a judge's ruling throwing out a felony conspiracy charge against former U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. DeLay, who announced this month that he is resigning his congressional seat, still faces a money laundering charge and another conspiracy charge stemming from the financing of state legislative races in 2002. A lower court judge dismissed a conspiracy charge against DeLay in December, agreeing with defense arguments that the conspiracy law did not cover election code violations in 2002. The legislature amended the law in 2003. Prosecutors had argued before a three-judge panel of the Third Court of Appeals that conspiracy to violate the election code had always been a crime and that the 2003 change merely clarified the law. DeLay, a Republican from Sugarland, stepped aside as majority leader last fall after he was indicted in Texas. He won his GOP primary in March, but later announced that he will resign from Congress in the coming weeks.
Staff changes continue at the White House today, with spokesman Scott McClellan resigning and Karl Rove staying on but changing roles. Democrats, meanwhile, say Rove should simply be fired. From Washington, D.C., Leanne Caldwell has more.
White House spokesperson Scott McClellan told President Bush he will leave his position.
It has been an extraordinary honor and privilege to have served you for more than 7 years now, the last 2 years and 9 months as your press secretary.
One of these days he and I are going to be rocking on chairs in Texas talking about the good old days of his time as the press secretary, and I can assure you I will feel the same way then that I feel now, that I can say to Scott, job well done.
For nearly 3 years, McClellan conducted daily news briefings with reporters where he was responsible for deflecting questions and passing along the president's agenda to the press. Someone not yet known will take over the job in 2 to 3 weeks. This is one of several staff changes announced after newly appointed White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolten, the former director of the Office of Management and Budget, began his post on Monday. Rob Portman, currently the U.S. Trade Representative, will replace Bolton at the OMB. Bolton will attempt to salvage low opinion polls of the president and deepening divides between the executive branch and Republican members of Congress ahead of midterm elections in 2006. Bolton's announcement to staff to either leave now or plan to stay through the elections reveal that they will be a top priority for upcoming months. A second change revealed today involves Karl Rove, the president's closest advisor who has been instrumental in shaping the Bush presidency. The decision, unconfirmed by the president, says he will keep his deputy chief of staff title but will no longer hold the duties of policy director, a role he was given shortly after the 2004 elections. That position will go to Joel Kaplan, Bolton's former deputy at the OMB. Instead, Rove will become head of political strategy and focus for the 2006 elections, in which Democrats could gain seats in Congress. Rove's new job description is not yet known. Also unclear is if this is a lateral move, a tactical change, or a demotion. But many are attempting to make some sort of sense of this. Bob Furtick, founder of Democrats.com, a progressive political blog, thinks that Roe is being sidelined because of the latest issues that the president has been at odds with the majority of the American public. They include the Dubai World Ports deal and Roe's involvement in the leak case of CIA operative Valerie Plame.
We have gas prices at $3. That's a policy issue. Karl Rove can't solve that problem while he's trying to stay out of jail and while he's trying to help Republicans win in November. And that's just one of a thousand issues that are boiling across the country.
Rove was a main player in compiling evidence into the lead-up to the war in Iraq. And he threatened to blacklist any Republicans who oppose the president in the NSA spying case. The Democratic Party said the White House shuffling is simply cosmetic and that Rove should quit. Susan Turnbull is vice chair of the Democratic National Committee.
It's shifting of positions, which is really merely engaging in window dressing. It's like moving the chairs on the Titanic. It's really not going to make any difference. What the president really needs to understand is that you can't just change this window dressing. You have to make changes in the administration policies.
Do you think that Karl Rove should be fired?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The president has resisted any changes to the position of defense secretary held by Donald Rumsfeld. Numerous congressional members and former generals are calling for his resignation. Other changes in the White House, though, are expected. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The current time is 5:40, and now time for more highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Well, well. Here comes yet another secret memo revealing how George W.'s Iraq attack has been, from the very start, a war of lies. You might recall that shortly before the March 2003 invasion, Bush was telling us that if Saddam Hussein did not give up his weapons of mass destruction, Iraq would face war. But earlier, in a January 31st closed-door meeting, Bush had informed his British buddy, Tony Blair, that the attack would take place even if no WMDs were found. Indeed, George and Tony candidly conceded that such weapons were not likely to be found. This bit of deliberate deception is unveiled in a confidential five-page memo written by David Manning, Blair's top foreign policy advisor who had participated in the meeting. The Manning memo confirms the substance of the now-famous Downing Street memo from 2002, in which other Blair aides reported that Bush was manipulating intelligence and facts in order to support his push to invade Iraq. Manning records that both Bush and Blair were uptight that the WMDs were not going to be found, for this totally undermined their public rationale for the invasion. So George W. offered another fabrication to give them an excuse to attack. He suggested that the U.S. would paint one of our own surveillance planes in the colors of the United Nations and fly it over Iraq, hoping that Saddam would be provoked into shooting it down. If so, the U.S. and Brits could invade, claiming that they were retaliating for Saddam's attack on the U.N. Ultimately, Bush and Blair chose to stick with the lie that Iraq had WMDs, apparently assuming that the war would end with a quick and popular victory, a new Iraqi democracy would spring up, and no one would remember all that WMD stuff. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, 2,300 Americans have died, Iraq is a bloody mess, and George W. says his war of lies will continue at least until 2009. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government.
Tonight's weather is partly cloudy, lows around 45. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs around 65. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri said today he would not relinquish his nomination to keep his current post. Al-Jafri's nomination by the Coalition of Religious Shiite Parties has the largest number of seats in the Iraqi parliament, continues to stall negotiations over forming the government 4 months after the country's elections. Sunni and Kurdish leaders complain that al-Jafri is too sectarian to lead his country effectively. One complaint that has long fallen by the wayside is that his government helped draft a constitution that takes away rights from women previously held in Iraq. FSRN's David Enders reports from Baghdad.
During the drafting of Iraq's constitution, Kurdish women led the fight for women's rights. During the last 15 years, women have enjoyed greater rights than other women in Iraq as Saddam Hussein's nominally secular government moved closer to embracing Islamic and tribal laws. In Baghdad in August, as the constitution was nearing its final draft and women's rights remained one of the unresolved issues, Zakia Haki, a Kurdish lawyer who was appointed Iraq's first female judge in 1959, related how she was told to abandon the debate by higher-ranking Kurdish officials who were more concerned about bargaining over the disputed oil city of Kirkuk. As well as supporting Islamic law as a basis for legislation, Jafari has called for a strong nationalist central government, and Kurdish leaders oppose him because they feel he threatens their bid for further autonomy.
It is just only outside they are freedom fighters, but inside, no. It is how can we build the future, the new future for Iraq, while more than 65% of Iraqi population, they are women. If you just leave them aside, it means this community will be paralyzed.
At Suleymaniye University in Iraqi Kurdistan, Professor Sarayan Taha Ahmed says that progressive women's rights laws in Kurdistan would be repealed with the implementation of the new constitution, but that women's rights in Kurdistan are not as developed as is sometimes argued.
We still have honor killings in rural areas where people are uneducated. The new constitution is bad for women's rights. It violates women's rights by separating their marital and personal rights by religious sect and bases everything on Islamic law.
Shenga Abdullah is a 22-year-old accounting student at the university.
The culture of Kurdistan does not give women their rights. If you do something that is not culturally correct, everyone talks about you. We don't have any freedom, and there is a big difference between men and women. We want equality.
Taha Ahmed said that at this point there is no movement to protect women's rights in Kurdistan because all of the women's rights groups in the country are controlled by one of the two ruling parties. The Iraqi government called an emergency meeting this evening after Jafari's announcement to discuss further governmental appointments. In Iraq, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
The World Bank is considering returning staff to Iraq and has offered $500 million in loans to help rebuild country's infrastructure. The bank said it would allow staff to return to Iraq only if it could guarantee their safety. The bank pulled out of Iraq nearly 3 years ago after the UN head's office was bombed and has since been overseeing Iraqi operations out of neighboring Jordan. The funds requested by the Iraqi authorities will be the first support given to them by the bank since 1973. In the UK, Tony Blair's government is now facing a parliamentary investigation over multi-million pound deficits in the public health service. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
When Tony Blair's Labour Party first came to office, the National Health Service that promised cradle-to-grave free healthcare for all was in a poor state. Yet despite record extra spending on health after years of neglect from previous governments, hospitals across the country are still reporting multi-million pound deficits. It's no mystery, says British doctor Jackie Davis.
Money now is going into the profits of the private sector as they become increasingly involved in delivering public health services in this country. There's no evidence that the involvement of the private sector improves the quality of healthcare or improves value for money. And in fact, when the people who promote the market involvement in public services are challenged, they simply cannot provide that evidence. So we have to resist the marketisation of public health services.
With deficits reaching more than $860 million, thousands of staff losing their jobs with thousands more job losses on the way, the parliamentary investigation will analyse what's gone wrong and how best to put it right. The local elections are only 2 weeks away, and Tony Blair's party is expected to lose a lot of seats. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A temporary exodus of rugby fans from Limerick, Ireland, threatens its status as a city and the European funding that goes with it when a population census is taken this Sunday and Monday. The mayor of Limerick in Western Ireland told Reuters that as many as 20,000 fans could follow the regional team to Dublin on Sunday for the Heineken Cup semifinals against Leinster. Many could stay on to celebrate or to drown their sorrows, knocking Limerick's population of 54,000 below the crucial threshold of 50,000. Scully called on Limerick rugby fans to return home by the morning after the match to be counted, saying that should the population fall below 50,000, Limerick would no longer be considered a city by European standards and would lose all EU funding. He also implored the census takers to be lenient in this case, saying, "I'm asking for a flexible interpretation of the morning. Let Monday morning stretch throughout the day. Let it stretch until midnight."
Britain's worst driver was behind bars last night after being banned from the roads for 9 lifetimes plus 109 years. 40-year-old John Williamson was locked up for 14 months yesterday after he admitted defying 8 previous life bans for drinking and driving. In 2000, Williamson was branded the worst driver in Scotland, if not the UK, after earning his 6th life ban. At the time, he claimed he only got behind the wheel when he was drunk. He also claimed he had never caused an accident, shortly before smashing into a police car. Yesterday, Williamson was banned for life for the 9th time after he admitted driving while disqualified and with no insurance. He was banned for another 10 years when he admitted failing to give a breath sample to police, bringing his running total to 109 years on top of the life bans. Williamson was jailed in 2004 after a police officer had to leap to safety as he drunkenly crashed into her car. Even then, he refused to stop and led officers on a 2-mile chase.
Recently, Oregon Democratic Congressman David Wu and several local experts addressed innovative ways to meet our nation's long-term energy needs while protecting the environment. The forum gave Oregonians the chance to learn about various local businesses and organizations committed to conserving energy, protecting our environment, and guiding our country onto a path towards energy independence. The main topics of discussion were increasing use of renewable power, developing alternative fuels such as biodiesel, incentives for green architecture, and development and smarter transportation planning to reduce car emissions.
On another lighter note, a dog who has collected 3,000 balls at his local golf club has been rewarded for his efforts with lifelong membership. Mongrel Terrier Deuce and his owner Jim often take a sunset stroll at Ponte Nuide Golf Club, and the pet can't resist going looking for lost balls. The balls he collects are handed out to the Monmouthshire Club young players. Deuce gets a lot of treats, but his rewards won't stretch to one thing. The clubhouse is out of bounds. Deuce's owner, Jim, explained his pet's talent, adding, quote, "He enjoys it when he gets going and really comes into his own when the grass is longer and the ferns have grown."
That's the Cable Evening News for Wednesday, April 19th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our assistant producer and audio editor is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporters Edison Carter, Doug Guidi, Sheila Whiteside, and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Eduardo de Landeros Thierry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, it's Joanne and Dave hosting Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Their guest is Jerry Levin, a former CNN Middle East bureau chief taken hostage in Lebanon in 1984. He now works in Palestine, promoting nonviolence and reporting on the Israeli military occupation. At 9, Carlos Chavez hosts Chicanismo. He'll focus on the recent nationwide rallies to support immigrant rights. At 9:30, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, it's a pilot program of anti-war poetry called Roadside Bomb. They'll focus on the parallels between World War I and the Iraq War, as shown through the work of Siegfried Sassoon. And at 10:30, Julie Bernard hosts Art Focus. Her guest is Brian Costello of PICA, the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thank you for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, the 19th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne is the president's pick to succeed Gail Norton as Secretary of the Interior.
Correspondent Elizabeth Wynne Johnson has this look on Kempthorne's environmental record and what it might mean for tribes who are concerned with drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or salmon recovery in the Northwest.
Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne isn't doing interviews these days about what he might hope to accomplish as Secretary of the Interior. His staff says he prefers to let the senators ask their questions first. That doesn't stop interest groups from speculating about what it would mean for Kempthorne to become the Bush administration's cabinet lead on all things environmental. Rick Johnson is head of the Idaho Conservation League.
The die is cast on oil and gas drilling, the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, other things like that. They've made clear what they want to do. And he was offered this job because he's going to help implement that.
As head of the agency that's ultimately responsible for directing endangered species policy, one area where Kempthorne could have a significant lasting impact is on salmon recovery. As governor, he's been an outspoken advocate. As for why it isn't working, he points to the federal government. Kempthorne has described state attempts without a federal plan in place as, quote, like running a race without a finish line. But Roger Singer, who represents the Northwest for the Sierra Club, says words aren't enough.
The clock is ticking. With 3 years left of a Bush administration, will he step up to the plate to finally take responsibility for protecting this Northwest icon? Will Interior Secretary Kempthorne actually follow through on the points that were made by Governor Kempthorne?
Singer is worried that Kempthorne would actually try to weaken the Endangered Species Act. Environmentalists say he's ignored calls for dam removal on the Lower Snake River. Instead, he's focused on improving passage at the dams and reducing commercial harvests.
He has consistently tried to remove the scientific input that goes along with endangered species protection and make it a much more political issue.
To Singer, that suggests a match between Kempthorne and the Bush administration. Federal recovery plans have repeatedly been rejected by an Oregon judge for failure to comply with the ESA. When Kempthorne sits down for his Senate confirmation hearings next month, it will be as a member in good standing of the Beltway Insider Club. The former senator has maintained close ties with his Washington colleagues, and he has a reputation as a consensus builder, able to broker bipartisan agreements and work closely with tribes. Florida Democrat Bill Nelson has made noises about blocking the confirmation because of Kempthorne's support for offshore drilling in the Gulf. I'm Elizabeth Wynne Johnson reporting.
In Wisconsin, the Ho-Chunk tribe has spent more than $1 million over the past 2 years buying ancestral land on the other side of the state from where most tribal members live. The land on the eastern shore of Green Bay is the site where many historians say one of the first French explorers made contact with the tribe in 1634. Gil Halstead has more.
There are no plans for a casino on the site. There is a statue of Jean Nicolet not far from the 10-acre property the Ho-Chunk recently bought. But tribal spokesperson Katie Matha says Nicolet's arrival there is not the reason the tribe bought the site, known as the Red Banks in tribal legends.
For as long as the Ho-Chunk can recollect, the Red Banks have been the home of our creation stories. So when the offer came up to purchase it, we went after it.
Matha says tribal members still visit the area to perform ceremonies honoring their origins. Historians don't agree exactly where Nicolet first made contact with Native Americans in Wisconsin, but anthropologist Nancy Laurie says 17th century documents from Jesuit missionaries provide strong evidence that when he arrived, the Ho-Chunk, then known as the Winnebago, were living in a well-fortified village on the shores of Green Bay. She says, unfortunately, residential development has destroyed the remains of ancient gardens the tribe cultivated there for centuries.
They're building a highway right down the spine of the peninsula, and they just wiped them out. There's been no real archaeological work on that aspect of it. The need to save what might be there is really crucial.
Most of the land the tribe has bought is undeveloped. Spokesperson Katie Matha says in addition to cultural preservation, the tribe is also committed to preserving the lakeshore savanna habitat around the site of their ancient village. It was non-Indian naturalists in the area concerned about plans for developing the site who helped negotiate the sale. Gil Halstead, Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's E-Edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.